Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Truth becomes art and art becomes truth. Therese Myatt's memoir is called Heartberries, and it's as fierce and shattering as it is transforming. She was recently named the Tecumseh Postdoctoral Fellow at Purdue University. She's in town for the South Dakota Festival of Books, but I spoke with her yesterday on the phone from Lafayette, Indiana.
I kind of was simultaneously writing a book of fiction, kind of inspired by my life. And I was also journaling and kind of experiencing a lot of turmoil in several of my relationships, like my family relationships and my relationship with my partner. So when I decided to complete my book of fiction, I realized that if I had just pared down all of the fictionalized elements of what I was writing, I had some really interesting exposition, and I also had all of these real life scenes that were honestly better truthfully, you know, like they were better in truth. So I made the book a memoir and kind of combed through and tried to make narrative sense of my life, which I think, you know, it brings healing to be honest, you know, it really does. So that's kind of the story of the book, you know?
When you go back to it again and again, because during the revision process, you know, you're, I'm guessing, sort of whittling away all the extra, and there's such clarity in the book, you have to revisit those scenes again and again and again. Was there more healing the next time and more healing the next time, something new each time you revisited it?
Yeah, and I think I also had to cultivate the work so that I created a reader experience, which is, it removes you a little from your life, and you're able to, you know, if you were like, if you had experienced a breakup and you were like, you know, what do I want my best friend to know? And I already know what she's going to think of me. I already know the advice she's going to give. How do I cut through that and get to the most expedient thing that I want to tell her? Only I was telling the world. So it was like, yeah. I was thinking about, how do I not mitigate? How do I not care about presenting myself as justified in actions that I wasn't justified in? And how do I present mental illness in a way where I'm not degrading a condition or trying to minimize anyone's experience, but exploring my own, you know?
Yeah. And you say, mm-hmm. Observation isn't easy, and the right eyes can make me feel like a deer, while the wrong ones make me feel like a monster. What's the role of the reader then, as you put the book into the world and, you know, you meet people who have now read it? Does the reader make a difference, you know, how they reflect this book back to you?
I think so. I think, you know, I've been really lucky to have people who want to, they want to read the book with like tenderness and like humanity. But there are certain times where I felt like, you know, people are voyeuristic and trying to look at my pain and kind of like, you know, judge my circumstance as something to pity as opposed to what's in the book, right? And I think in those cases, it's so true that, you know, it depends on the eyes looking at you. And it, for the most part, I've had really positive experiences, but putting yourself out there is, it's really terrifying because, you know, a lot of people don't have a lot of familiarity in talking about mental illness in a way that's like respectful, or, you know, they minimize women's pain, and that's kind of common, you know? I mean, if we just look at the politics, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
there's
a line when you are, you know, signing the paperwork to check yourself in to get some help, and the sentence is, "I was signing a new treaty." And when I read that, I gasped out loud, and I had to stop and give myself as a reader time to process everything that was contained in that one sentence. But your life just keeps going. I mean, did you have those moments as a writer where you're like, yeah, I could write two more paragraphs about this, but I'm going to give the reader a sentence and trust that they're going to see the universe within?
Yeah, I think trusting, you know, and thank you. I think trusting the reader really did pay off. I think I knew taking those risks of reducing down on a line level so that I could cut any kind of contrivance that wasn't serving the book and serve a good line that does enough work if the reader gives me credit, right? I knew the risk was someone reading it and thinking it a missed opportunity. But I didn't want to spoon feed anyone because I really did trust that they knew that this was aiming for art, you know?
Yeah.
And I think art, most of the time it is about risk, you know? So I was like really looking forward to hearing feedback. Like you just said that the line actually worked, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, God.
I have a list of them and yeah. It's such a, you know, it's a beautifully designed book. The cover is lovely. So I wasn't going to mark it up, you know, I'm just going to read it. And it was precious to me. And then I couldn't help myself. You know, I have to mark these words and these sentences and I have to annotate. And so it ends up being this sort of living, breathing book as well as I make my way through it and then back through it again. And I watched an interview that you did on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. And there something stuck out with that interview to me where you're telling him about, you know, breaking down, oh, you were in a pretty good, you know, you were lucky, you were in kind of a good place where you could do this. And then you're like, no, actually I wasn't. After that, I got evicted. And I thought, is she processing that just right now during the interview where you're trying to make it into it? Like, well, actually it wasn't so bad. No, it was. It was terrible.
Yeah.
So as you talk about the book, are you having those moments too? You were like, oh yeah, that's right. That really was as awful as I remember it.
Yeah, because I was trying to do a service for people. Like I was trying to say, oh, like most people don't have the luxury to break down and they have to go to work. So like what ends up happening is I think it manifests in the body when you can't take care of yourself emotionally. Mm. And that's why, you know, you see chronic illness. Like my mother was chronically ill, but she also had aneurysm. And I really do think a lot of that was the stress of having to force herself to get to work, no matter if she was broken inside or not. And so I was trying to communicate, oh, I had the luxury to break down. But then I was like, no, I didn't. I actually got evicted. So I think it's like, that's the other thing is it shouldn't be that way, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of times where I'm talking about my experiences and trying to speak from a place of privilege when I realize, oh, no, wait, I'm not privileged. Like, you know, things are better in my life, but I'm still still trying to get ahead because when you start the race, you know, behind, it's hard, you know.
Yeah.
So illustrating that is really difficult for me because, you know, I've never been in a position of moderate power, a place where I had a voice, and I feel everything is so new that I still have to process and position myself, you know, and realize, oh, wait, like, you know, I'm still struggling. I'm still, you know, I don't know where I'm going to be in a year, and trying to communicate that effectively so that people know that I'm a real person. I think that's really important to me, you know?
Yeah. So what's the difference for you in having a voice and having authority? Because you write about, you know, this sense of living in the world with an authority.
Yeah, I think everyone has voice. The only thing is not many of us have the time and space to really speak and be heard, you know? And I think authority for me, how it feels is that I actually do qualify myself as the most credible person to talk about my experiences. And I hadn't always done that. I used to let social workers talk for me. I used to let therapists tell me what the real problem was. And I realized, like, no, I'm actually the authority of my life. And I think that's a real epiphany for somebody who had just trusted wholly and completely that, they didn't know any better. They weren't good enough to know better for themselves and things like that.
How do you get to that place? How do you help someone else get on the path to that place where they understand they are the authority of their own experience?
I think it was being really defiant in opposing kind of forces that really tried to narrow my experiences and who I was. And it was years of practice. It was like, even today, you know, someone might speak over me or say something disrespectful, and I'll go home and I'll think about it and say, I should have said something. You know, I really should have spoken up for myself. So then I do that on the page, you know. And I think people really need to find a place, like a good place to really like relay their truth, you know, and whether that's crafting something or giving back to their communities or forming artwork, like it's a good way to find your real power, you know. And for me, it was on the page.
Yeah. You know? You write about how nobody wants to know why Indian women or Indigenous women leave. Where do they go? What happens when they disappear? And you write often about, you know, men objectify me to such a degree that they forget that I eat. And being unseen, mm-hmm. being invisible. As you wrote the book, was there a part of you that thought, no one will read this because no one cares to read this? This will be an invisible book.
I think that's the crazy thing, is I really didn't think that it would have the gravity it does, you know. And I was fine, you know, I did it for the sake of the work, like, you know, because creating a book like this, it was almost like I knew that it was not going to be like this massive thing, and then it turned into a massive thing. So it's like, even now I think it doesn't even fit with me that the reality is that people, if you give them the story in your own way, which for me was very experimental, very individual, and it also communicated a lot about the legacy of my family. And the power of that, for me, I had to give it 100%, like everything I had in terms of my heart. And to have people receive that, I think it speaks to things can change, you know. And I think if we give more Indigenous people platforms, and if we give them the time and space to really illustrate what's going on in our communities and what's going on, you know, in our classrooms and things like that, I feel like really things can change, you know. And I really didn't think anyone would read the book. I really didn't. So it's so great.
They're reading the book. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. Because I'm like, you know, it's just not real. Like, I really haven't. I think things become real like 10 years later or something. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. There's another moment in the book where you talk about ladybugs and you're, you know, you're killing them, and it's a surprise. And why would anybody, you know, just so relentlessly slaughter ladybugs? And then you tell this story of the role ladybugs have played in your history. And it speaks to this idea that people do things for a reason, and it's not necessarily the reason that exists in your life. Describe that scene for me, and why you included it, and sort of what you maybe hope a reader might experience from that explanation of a simple thing like a ladybug, which is not so simple.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was growing up, our house was infested with ladybugs. So it was like, for me, what a ladybug represented, you know, where it like signified the smell of mold. You know, it has such a specific smell when you kill them and when they fester. And, you know, for me, I always consider it the most unlucky sign, you know. And it creates a sense of fear, because I think that's how trauma works. It just kind of comes back in weird ways, and you have no idea how it will trigger you. And you feel like you can move on, and then that one thing just comes back. And for me, it was really important to illustrate that for my husband, because I feel like he did not understand how so many things took on a large meaning for me. And to tell him the story of, like, you know, why ladybugs scare me, or why I really don't see them as anything special, and in fact, it's, you know, it's the opposite, or why service at a restaurant could bring back memories of my mother not receiving good service, and also sometimes being insulted, you know.
Yeah.
Communicating that, I had to do it, because it, you know, I think telling him made him love me more. You know, I think everyone has a story, and everyone has an anxiety about something, and I feel like knowing more about people in terms of the little things, you know, the little things, the little pieces of their life that make them whole, I think that always makes me love the person more. You know, I think that it's a big baseline for empathy.
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I think that for, you know, I'm an empathetic person, but reading that, I was like, oh, I don't know that I'll ever see the world the same way as I saw the world before I read Hardberries. And that's not an overstatement of the impact of this book. How do you teach other people to write their stories in a way that becomes art, and in a way that can live beyond just maybe what they would put in a notebook in a therapeutic setting? How do you help guide other people on that same journey?
I think, thank you. And I think when someone tells you a story, it's often the details that are oddly specific that really sing in the story. So I know, you know, when I hear, for example, someone tell me, you know, about their grandmother, you know, and how much they love their grandma, and they talk about their favorite dish that their grandma cooked, I always remember their favorite dishes, you know, like chicken and dumplings, like, and I remember how they describe them. And I think people should really pay attention to and capture the things they know they'll want their children to witness or bear witness to when they're old enough, you know, like the things that really make you human, and the things you want to be known for the rest of your life. It's like, trying to capture those things feels so urgent when you realize time goes by so fast, and you forget what you were like as a 12-year-old girl, you know, and you wish you could capture that essence and remember your favorite things. And, you know, like for me, that was like Lisa Frank, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, like finding those little details that really resonate and create a realistic picture for someone else. I think those are the ways in, you know, and the more you interrogate that and try to, and really, really try to be honest. And I think honesty is so interesting to me, because I don't believe it's a pure thing that you can ever fully capture, you know? Mm. And I think the closer I get to it, the better I'm doing. And the more people believe what I'm saying, then I know I'm a good storyteller, because it is about transmission, right? Like I want to give this person all of these details and all of the importance, you know?